I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Union men, my ass. You want to be treated like men? You want to be treated fair? Well, you ain't men to that coal company. Your equipment, like a shovel, a gondola car, a hunk of wood brace. They'll use you until you wear out or you break down or you're buried under a slate fall, and then they'll get a new one. And they don't care what color it is or where it comes from. It doesn't matter how much coal you can load or how long your family has lived on this land. If you stand alone, you're just so much shit to those people. You think this man is your enemy? Huh? This is a worker. Any union keeps this man out ain't a union. It's a goddamn club. Now they got you fighting white against colored, native against foreign, holler against holler. When you know there ain't but two sides of this world, them that work and them that don't. You work, they don't. That's all you got to know about the enemy.
What you just heard was a clip from the acclaimed 1987 John Sills feature, Matwan, which dramatized a very real and historic 1920s coal miners' strike in the hills of West Virginia. The character whose speech you were just listening to is the film's protagonist, the union organizer Joe Canahan. Although Canahan is technically a fictional character, the truth is that he was inspired by very real union organizers from groups like the Industrial Workers of the World, whose membership envisioned a future where workers of the world would unite against oppression and the exploitation of their labor. The struggle for a fairer, more just world continues on today. And it just so happens that many of the wars being waged in the present day by organizers and activists seeking to create a better world for we, the people, are being fought on the very same battlegrounds where men like Joe Canahan waged their wars. Case in point with West Virginia, where only a few short years ago, many of the direct descendants of the Battle of Matwan participated in the West Virginia teachers' strike of 2018. For most of the American public, however, this history remains hidden, obscured from view. Some, however, are hard at work uncovering this hidden history of struggle, including our guest on this edition of the program, artist and activist Eleanor Goldfield, director of the new documentary Hard Road of Hope, which chronicles the rich history of resistance and activism in West Virginia from the mine wars of a century ago to the battles of today like the fight against a dying coal industry and the detrimental effects of fracking. And with that being said, let's dive right into the conversation with Eleanor Goldfield, the documentarian behind Hard Road of Hope. Welcome to Parallax Views, Eleanor Goldfield, director of the new documentary, Hard Road of Hope. Very interesting documentary about the reign of coal companies and their corrupt enterprise in West Virginia. I have to say, Eleanor, I was a big fan of this documentary because my grandmother was a coal miner's daughter.
Nice. Yeah. No. I've heard from several folks that this struck them not just because of the coal, but just because it's a common American story. This oppression via industry.
So before we get into the documentary, maybe you could give my listeners a little bit of background on yourself. Maybe what led you to do this documentary and some of your journalistic endeavors prior to this and your activist endeavors.
Sure. So I am a creative activist and a journalist. On the activism side, I do community organizing, activist trainings, and frontline support. And in terms of journalism, it's basically the same thing, but from behind the camera or, behind the pen, I suppose. And in terms of the West Virginia piece, I had originally planned to go down there just to get like a report basically for my show that I had on Free Speech TV at the time. And after basically like less than 2 days there, I realized there's way more here than I could fit into a half hour report back. And it was also kind of a pivotal moment for me just in terms of like focusing on what mediums that I want to do, because I realized that I actually prefer to do the deeper storytelling that you can't really do on a weekly news show. So it was a good time for me to shift that focus and also to do it in a place like West Virginia that is so, you know, it's like the butt end of jokes. It's this throwaway place with throwaway people. Who cares, you know? So it felt like a good place and people to do that with, because of that, like, that juxtaposition of the reality of the situation versus people's perception of the place and the people.
Out of curiosity, where did you grow up? Because was it like a culture shock to you in West Virginia? Are you from the area or?
So it wasn't a culture shock. It was a shock for different reasons, like, wow, this place is beautiful and nobody talks about that. But I partially grew up in North Carolina. So poor white Southern communities are no stranger to me. I also have, however, partially grew up in Sweden. So my mom's Swedish and my father's not. So that kind of dictated sort of my political and social understandings from a very early age. And so West Virginia was not a culture shock. It was more so a shock because growing up in North Carolina, West Virginia was always like the butt end of jokes. Like there were so many West Virginia jokes, just like how in Sweden there are all these Norwegian jokes and Danish jokes. And then when you go to West Virginia, you realize that's, you know, all of these jokes are not only ridiculous, but there's such a vibrant history here and the people are awesome. And, you know, the place is awesome in so many ways. And it's really the propagandization and the corporate malfeasance that have been at fault, not somehow the people.
Yeah, I wanted to get into maybe a little bit of the history of West Virginia. I recently had a guest on, John Sills, who famously did the movie Matwan, about the Matwan massacre. There's a huge history of labor struggles in West Virginia.
Totally. You know, the Matwan massacre is something, there's someone in the film who grew up in Matwan, and she works at the museum there, the Mine Wars Museum. She said that, you know, I grew up in Matwan and no one ever told me this history. Which is like and if you've ever been to Matwan, like, or for those of you who haven't, it looks like a backlot. it's like this tiny little town with like these adorable train tracks. And then there's like this small little main street with like the adorable, you know, like single story little stores and things. And to be in a place that small, I mean, most places in West Virginia are small. It's the second most rural state in the nation. But to be in a place that small and to be amputated from your own history is so remarkable. And this is a, you know, this is a common theme, like the Matewan Massacre, the Mine Wars, the Battle of Blair Mountain. These are things that happened, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century that were really like, you know, cornerstone moments of the labor rights movement in this country that has been, you know, silenced and oppressed so diligently by the ruling class. But West Virginia was a huge part of that. And we see tidbits of that, you know, coming back, like everyone, when the teachers' strike started happening, everyone's like, West Virginia? Question mark. But really, that's not that odd. If you look at the trajectory of history, it's actually just a continuation of that radicalism that was born in these coal towns where black and white and immigrant mine workers marched together and actually fired on coal barons and won some basic workers' rights, like being paid in American money. And so that history is so vibrant, and it's really like, it really speaks to what the fact that uncovering your past, your community's past, is a form of grassroots activism.
It's interesting. I've always heard when it comes to the teacher strikes, especially in West Virginia, people have said to me, well, you know, it's in their blood. You know, a lot of those teachers, their grandparents were fighting, you know, the coal companies.
Totally. Yeah. And I remember sitting down with somebody at the Mine Wars Museum who works there. And she said, if you ever said scab to my grandfather, he would lose his mind. You know, that was like a dirty word in our house. And what's really fascinating is like how that's shifted. And now, you know, you have coal miners that are marching against regulations, not just for the environment, but for their own safety. And a former coal miner that I speak to in the film, you know, says that like, oh, that's the new thing now. It's regulations. That's why we're out of work. And his response is, no, regulations are why you're here, because if it weren't for regulations, your grandfather would have died and you wouldn't be here running your mouth. But it really speaks to how powerful that propagandization is. And like, even just something as simple as the word redneck, which is now a very derogatory term for like a stereotypical white, you know, far right zealot, really comes from the mine wars, where mine workers tied red bandanas around their necks and marched together, the black, the white, the migrant mine workers. That was like an identifier and a way to show pride in their striking. And so that's where, and so, you know, you'll see posters on like the Mine Wars Museum and things that say like, we're proud rednecks. And like bringing back that term to mean something about solidarity and community and human rights, as opposed to what it means now.
I was going to say, so I'm going to have a few younger listeners that will say, what are the Mine Wars? I didn't learn about this in school. Maybe you could give some background. I know it only takes up a portion of the film, but I always assume I have newbie listeners that are starting to get interested in this stuff that may be unfamiliar. They may even be unfamiliar with terms like scab. So maybe we could get into a little bit of that.
Sure. So real quick, scab just means somebody that's hired by a company to cross the picket line, which means that, you know, the picket line being where union workers or workers that want to unionize are holding space and refusing to work. They're going on strike to gain a certain amount of basic worker rights. A scab is the person that crosses that line in order to continue working. And these are usually people that the company finds to work at much lower rates, of course, that are subject not only to the oppression then of the company, but then also blowback from the workers who are, you know, rightfully angered by the fact that this person is crossing their picket line. So that's a scab. And the mine wars, and, you know, of course, I recommend folks check out the film to learn more about this. But the mine wars were like basically a series of altercations, I guess, or actions, strikes, and things like that that happened not just in West Virginia, but throughout mining country, that really saw workers overcoming the divide and conquer mentality in order to band together and win some basic human rights, of which, you know, I mentioned like being paid in American money, because before then you were paid in what's called company scrip, which folks might know the song, like, I sold my soul to the company store. That's what he's talking about, because you would only be paid in company dollars, which you could use at the company store, but you couldn't like quit your job and then move somewhere else and use that. So it was a way to keep you like an indentured servant to that company. You lived in a company house. You worked with company tools. You had no ownership or rights over your own labor. So the mine wars were a pivotal moment that pushed back against this. And it's really important to note like how they pushed back, because when these people were put into the mining towns, they were put on different parts of the mine that were specific to their, you know, group. And then they were told things like, you know, don't talk to the black mine workers that came from, you know, down south because they're savages. Don't talk to the Jews because they eat babies or whatever, you know, like this, these kind of ridiculous things. But that plus the language barriers that people had as migrants really kept people apart. And so just imagining, of course, like with all of those barriers, and of course, without like modern organizing tools, they overcame those divide and conquer tactics in order to band together and fight for their, like combined, community rights as workers. And so that's incredibly powerful. And you know, I'm not surprised that industry wants to bury that history, because it's a powerful example of what we are capable of when we come together and fight for common goals.
Yeah, I was going to say that movie I mentioned, John Sills' Matwan, it actually portrays that, how the black and Italian and the sort of poor rural white workers in Matwan all sort of came together despite, you know, the industries trying to pit them against each other. And I think that gets overlooked a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it is not something that the ruling class wants us to think is possible, right? They want us to think that, you know, whites can't organize with blacks because, oh, you're just too different. And, you know, you can't organize with a Latinx community because they don't speak your language and they don't want to. You know, like all of these, and I still, you know, it's still very, very, very clear today, these divisions, that keep us from organizing and keep us from understanding our shared oppression. And I think the important part here is that we're not, and I mentioned this in the film too, because, towards the end, I highlight, you know, an experience and some commentary from an indigenous journalist whose ancestral homelands include Southern West Virginia. She's Cherokee. And it's this idea that my oppression is not the same as yours. Of course, you know, indigenous peoples carry a much different type and level of oppression than I do. But we can sometimes and oftentimes get stuck in what she actually, my friend, calls the oppression Olympics. Like if I'm more oppressed than you, therefore we can't organize together because you don't get it. That's not the point. The point is that we all share oppression under this system, and we can find intersections of that oppression together, and also connections that aren't based on oppression, but based on like shared values. Like, what do we want to see in the world? And those connections are so important. And that's really an important you know, thing to highlight when we do our organizing. So not to say that everybody's experience under this system is the same, of course they're not, but to move past that, not just to recognize that these diverse experiences are important, but also to recognize that what we want to build, what we want to see for our family, for our community, are so similar. And those are really great intersecting points.
That interview you mentioned near the end, where you're dealing with the indigenous struggle, it was interesting because you did that right in front of a building. I believe it was like the Pocahontas Mining Company. And I'm like, wow, who picked that name? This is awful.
Yeah, no, it was, and we went there on purpose because there's actually a town called Pocahontas, and there's a plaque there, And it gives this sort of Disney story, like, oh, Pocahontas met and married this British guy, and then he took her home, and it was beautiful. And it's like, no, he kidnapped this this indigenous, who was really like a child at the time, you know, 13. And so we went there on purpose because my friend, the journalist, Jen Dierenwater, wanted to go there and, you know, give a statement in front of it and speak to not just the continued like rape of the land and the oppression of the land and the people, but also like how this meshes with like how we kind of use that oppression as like a, you know, a symbol of American pride. You know, like the Redskins is another good example. Like, oh, it's a symbol of America, this football team with this like decapitated Native American head and this derogatory name. And the Pocahontas mine is another example of that. Like, you're literally naming the company that is like violently extracting resources from stolen land, you're naming that after an indigenous person whose like family and community you basically destroyed. I mean, it's so twisted, the psychology of that situation. And it really speaks to, you know, the importance of like how we represent and how we talk about indigenous issues and how we understand them as like still being here. And that's another thing that I mentioned in the film, is that we talk about indigenous communities as if like that happened a long time ago. Like, they went the way of the pilgrim. They don't exist anymore. As opposed to, no, they're still very much here. It's just that the only time we hear about them is like the Redskins or like on Thanksgiving. And so really highlighting the importance of discussing these issues. And again, those intersections, you know, indigenous rights are environmental rights, are, you know, racial justice, are like women's rights and things like that. Like, all of these things are connected, and we have a much, we don't have a chance at all unless we band together like the mine workers did, but we have a much better chance of making progress if we recognize these shared intersections, again, not just of oppression, but of what we'd like to build.
It's interesting. I've been referencing to people lately, you know, the rapper Ice-T in his band Body Count, he has a song called No Lives Matter, where he says at the beginning, you know, we say Black Lives Matter because apparently a lot of people don't realize that. But if you're poor and white, you know, the cops don't really care about you either. But we say Black Lives Matter because the institution needs to be made to recognize that. We're not going to take it lying down. But I've never met an activist who will say, oh yeah, the poor people in West Virginia, they're our enemy. You know, I've never seen that. I think a lot of the activists I know get painted with the wrong sort of brush in that regard. I think a lot of activists just believe we have a shared struggle.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do think, having worked in organizing spaces for quite a while, one of the problems that I see is that it's omission. It's not that anybody goes up and actively says, like, you know, these people don't matter. It's that they don't do the outreach to poor white communities. And this is another thing that West Virginia has struggled with. You know, one of the former mine workers told me that, you know, well-meaning like NGOs, environment, like Big Green, will come in and be like, let me tell you what you need to do, and let me tell you why you're wrong for working in the mines, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and talk down to people, and then expect them to respond with, oh yes, of course, yes, you're right. That's not how people work, right? And then the only other groups doing outreach, of course, as we know, are like the KKK and, you know, extreme right-wing groups that come instead with this, like, oh, you're so wonderful because you're white and you're, you know, you should take pride in your oppression under the system, like, totally twisted. But if you had to choose between that and, you know, like an NGO saying that you're wrong and evil for working in the mines and you should know better, you're going to choose, you know, the far right option. So I think, like, the other thing that I wanted to highlight with this film is that we need to do a better job on the left of reaching out to these communities and making those connections like the mine workers made, and understanding that also, when we go into these communities, don't talk down to people. And I hate when people say, like, oh, you're going down to Louisiana or you're going to North Carolina, so you have to, like, dumb down the way you talk. If I were going to France and I had to speak French, would I say that I have to dumb myself down to speak French? No, it's just a different way of speaking. And I think that that's a very important thing to do as well, because when we, you know, I've had the privilege of, you know, of a very good education. Most people in this country don't, unless they want to, like, join the military and literally kill people in order to learn. So I think that it's important that we recognize that part of it as well, and recognize that building community takes time, and going into a community and recognizing their understanding of their oppression and their needs is really something that you need to listen to, as opposed to going in and telling them this is how you need to address your issues.
Yeah, it reminds me of, and I know some people have criticisms of her, but Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, when she was first sort of, you know, gaining a lot of steam, people kept pointing out that she would code switch based on who she was talking to. And I'm like, I don't get it. Why is that an issue? Like, we always change how we speak depending on audience.
Totally. And we should. You know, the way that I speak with you is not the way that I'm going to speak to, like, people in Sweden that I organize with, or people in West Virginia. These are different ways of speaking. And also, again, like, of listening. You know, I like to say that, like, you might not have the academic language, but no one needs to be told what oppression feels like. So I think that that's, you know, it's about, like, and again, like, it's a slow work. And from the South, like, I'm used to things going a little slower sometimes, but it's going out and sitting on a porch with a guy, having a beer, and talking about why you hate the government. And having those conversations where it's clear that you're not walking into it with this clear ulterior motive of, like, having them sign your petition or whatever, but, like, building that connection is so important. And that's really where, you know, where that deep organizing happens.
It's interesting too. I liked that there was like a bit of footage in the film showing actual protests, and those protests seemed multiracial. You know, there were Black activists, there were coal miners, sort of all marching together. And I think people forget about that when we talk about places like West Virginia. We sort of paint it, I think we paint the Appalachian region of the U.S. in a really sort of cartoonish way, that sort of J.D. Vance hillbilly elegy type picture. And I think it's BS.
It totally is. And I mean, I think it's, I mean, West Virginia is majority white. That is, you know, demographically the case. But there is, again, like, that deep history of organizing as communities. And poor white communities have way more in common with poor Black communities than they do with rich white communities, you know? And this sort of, this class analysis is something that has been purposefully removed from our education and our understanding, because it's a lot more efficient for, you know, the powers that be to keep us going at each other, you know, Black, white, and you're from this place and you're from that place and your parents or whatever, than to recognize, like, wow, we all have the same problem with the same people that are up there and we're down here, as opposed to arguing amongst ourselves. So yeah, it's a class analysis that that is purposely kept away from folks.
No, I'm curious. I don't want to give the whole movie away. I want people to see it. But what are some of the sort of main things happening in West Virginia now? We talked about the mining wars, right? The mine wars. But how has the sort of oppression continued? How has the corruption of the coal companies continued in West Virginia?
Sure, yeah. So what's happening right now is actually kind of like a transfer of power, because as one person explained to me, it's like what coal is doing now is they're trying to scrape the very last peanut butter out of the jar. And what we see basically with mountaintop removal is it's kind of like fracking for coal, because the easy to get to coal has already been removed from the mountains, where, you know, back in the day, they just dig back into the mountain. Now you have to blow the entire top off a mountain to get to the coal seams. Same thing with fracking. All the easy to get to oil is already, you know, it's, you've already gotten it. Now you have to literally like frack into these little fissures. So coal is dying, and there's nothing that anybody can do about it. You know, even Trump, you know, getting rid of regulations that, to be perfectly honest, under Obama weren't really regulations anyway. Even subsidizing coal worth billions of dollars is not going to save coal, because if it's just not there, it's just not there. So what's happening now is that West Virginia, because it is a very captured state in terms of it being, you know, it was founded as a resource colony. It's captured in terms of the elected officials for, you know, by and large are, you know, the servants of industry. And so they're making the space for coal to shift seamlessly to fracking. And what I mean by that is that, like, the same, like, lack of regulation adheres to fracking as it did to coal. The same propaganda that you'll see, you know, like, oh, if you like electricity, you like coal. Now it's like, if you like electricity, you like fracking. And this sort of this sort of transition of power and propaganda for the people of West Virginia. And, of course, at the end of the day, they still get, you know, a bum deal. West Virginia is the third poorest state in the nation. And, you know, some $5 trillion of coal have been mined out of the hills of West Virginia since the advent of coal. And the people who mined it are not the ones living off of that those riches. So the same thing is happening with fracking, of course. And so it's a very jagged transition of power, in the sense of, you know, it continuing to oppress and destroy, both in terms of public health and, of course, the environment. But it's a very seamless transition with regards to elected officials and, of course, the industry.
There's one group in particular that I did not know about before watching this documentary, but there's actually an organization called Friends of Coal. What is that?
Oh, yeah. So Friends of Coal, you'll see these signs all over West Virginia. Friends of Coal was created. It's an interest group that was created by the coal industry. And it's part of like this large, it's perhaps like the spearhead of the propaganda machine that says things like, oh, if you want electricity, you want coal. And it's basically this entity that has captured the hearts and minds of the people of West Virginia. And, you know, one of the folks that I speak to in the film talks about that level of propagandization when he talks about Friends of Coal. And he's a former coal miner himself, and a member of the UMWA, the United Mine Workers of America. And he talks about how you'll see two different types of cars with a Friends of Coal sticker. One is like an $80,000 SUV. And the other one is like an 88, like, I don't know cars, but an 88, you know, mess of a car with the fenders falling off. Now, the first guy totally understands what Friends of Coal means, because Friends of Coal as an interest group actively and like harshly lobbies against everything like pensions and healthcare plans and regulations and all of these things, in particular union, like they're classic union busters. And then the guy with, so like that first car totally gets it. But the second car with the fenders falling off should have had a Friends of Coal Miners sticker. Because Friends of Coal legit just means that you are a friend of the industry that, once again, is raping and pillaging land and people for their own profit. So, I mean, there are other interest groups like this, you know, out there in the world, but in West Virginia, Friends of Coal has really captured the hearts and minds of people. And, you know, there's another guy in the film who makes the point that people have like grown up feeling that their identity is connected to the coal industry. So that what they feel that when somebody says no to coal, they're actually saying no to them as a person. And that is a deep level of propaganda that is relatively new, because the guy that I spoke to, who's, you know, in his 50s or 60s, former mine worker, said that when he, you know, joining a union was the most important thing that he ever did. And so in his mind, he wasn't so much connected to coal deeply as he was connected to the idea of being a union worker and, you know, workplace organizing. So this has shifted just in the matter of like a few decades. And it really speaks to how powerful that propaganda is. And of course, like the sliver of hope here is, well, if they can do that, then we can do, not to the same extent, but we can do a lot of work just by uncovering not only their, you know, their like evil propaganda, but by uncovering our history and building a better narrative through our history and what we want our future to look like.
You know, I was going to add to that. I mean, these coal companies certainly don't care about the remaining coal miners. I mean, they're trying to screw them over on pensions now, as you point out in the documentary.
Totally, yeah. The one of the biggest, just a few days before I got to West Virginia in October, late October, November of last year, went bankrupt. And this guy is a billionaire. And then he lobbied hard to ensure that he wouldn't have to pay pensions for his mine workers. And last year, Congress passed for the first time a bailout for the coal industry so that we as taxpayers would take on pension plans for a lot of these mine workers. And, you know, here is that important distinction where I don't at all mind my tax dollars going to ensure that people have things like, you know, a pension and healthcare and things like that. But that's not what that is paying for. That is paying to make sure that the coal barons make off with their golden parachute and put the burden of those decades of, you know, health issues and pensions that they promised their workers, that's now on us. That's not right. So that's an important distinction to make. And, you know, the courts of both Kentucky and West Virginia have allowed these big coal companies to basically claim that they're bankrupt, while the CEOs and, you know, other people who own stock in the company make off with golden parachutes and then leave workers without pensions because, look, oh, I'm sorry, we're bankrupt. Nothing we can do to help you. You're on your own. And this is, you know, combined with other horrific tactics like, you know, there's a infamous doctor in West Virginia known as Dr. No, he worked for the coal companies and would routinely tell miners who came to see him, you don't have black lung. And of course, as a coal miner, you don't have access to pick whichever doctor you want. You go to their doctor. And then this doctor says, you don't have black lung, basically so that we don't have to pay for it. And you have these people dying in their, you know, late 30s and 40s because they have black lung that basically they were told that they didn't have.
So I guess the response some people would have, right, is, well, why would anyone want to fight for these coal companies? What, like, why do they still want to be, why are there people that still want to be coal miners? I mean, you're getting black lung, you're harming your body. You know, to play devil's advocate, how would you respond to the people that sort of have this really snubbing their nose at the workers mentality?
Totally. And I get it. And I think, you know, who wants to work at Walmart? Who wants to work in oil? People don't make these choices because they're super gung-ho about getting black lung. They make these choices, because they're, you know, they're propagandized into it. But more importantly, they have no choice. In West Virginia, which is, again, the third poorest state in the nation, the second most rural, your choices are work at Walmart or work for coal. And you make a lot more working for coal. And so the choice that people basically have is, do I want to watch my family starve or do I want to work for coal? And that's why it's so important that we recognize that lack of choice, the economic force that these people are under. They're not working for coal because they have some evil plan to, you know, destroy the planet. They're working for coal because they don't have a choice. And I spoke to it's the same with fracking, you know, which is happening, you know, more towards the middle and the north of the state. they're taking kids out of high school and saying, you know, you don't need to go to college here. You can start working in the fracking industry. You're going to get like $70,000 a year. That's a nice gig. And if your choice is between that and trying to find a way to pay for college and then, I don't know, do what exactly, because your job market is horrific. So we really have to recognize the position that these people are in when they start working these jobs. And that will definitely help with that sort of like, I can't believe you work in that. Like, I know it's awful. And there are a lot of efforts actually in West Virginia and Kentucky to have coal miners retrained for, you know, renewables and other jobs like that. But it requires a lot more social and political push to make that a reality.
Now, one thing I noticed was in some of the interviews in this documentary, the issue of politics sort of comes up, right? You were at the Mine Wars Museum, and I remember the one interviewee was saying, you know, some of the people involved in the Mine Wars, they weren't really Reds. Well, some of them may have been. She laughed. And I'm not judging her for that, but like, I do think that there was a very left-wing element involved in these Mine Wars, right? And I myself am very left-wing, so I'm okay with that. But I do think there is like this discomfort a lot of people have because they've been propagandized so much against left-wing activism. So, you know, she's saying that they weren't all, you know, call me Reds, and I believe in solidarity. But I'm like, that is a left-wing thing. How did you sort of witness that sort of approach to politics? It seems like there can be a little bit of discomfort for a lot of people.
Totally. And I'm glad that you picked up on that, because I kept that in on purpose, because I get called a communist, a socialist, an anarchist, and things that I can't say on radio, but it's like all one thing, right? It's like this lump leftist evil that people have this perception of. And I think what's really powerful about that is that her next comment is, I don't care what you call it, because it's a beautiful, you know, it's beautiful to fight for these kind of ideals. And it's like, okay, that right there speaks, like you said, to the propaganda, but it also speaks to a way that we can like engage with folks. You know, from coast to coast, people are afraid of the word socialist, and people are really afraid of the word anarchist and communist, and they don't know the difference between any of those things. And it's like, I think it's important to have those conversations and for people to know what these terms mean and how horrifically twisted the US government has gotten it on purpose. But I think in the immediacy, it's important to go to these people and say, hey, do you think you should have to go bankrupt paying for healthcare? Do you think that you should have to work 40 hours a week and not have enough money to have a home? Like, sure, the answer to those questions might be socialist, but instead of couching it that way, we can find a way to talk about it so that that doesn't even enter into it. And one of my favorite writers and organizers and friends is Scott Crow, who talks about, like, you know, he basically helped build the Common Ground movement in New Orleans after Katrina. And he said, you can talk about political theory, but it's about doing it. And if you actively start doing it, before you know it, you have a bunch of anarchists around you that don't even call themselves that. And it doesn't matter if they do or don't. So, you know, the idea of like actively, you know, working your politics or your ideas is really far more important than having a conversation about them, you know, like living your philosophy, living the policy that you want to see, which can sound kind of trite and like, oh, that's very fluffy language. But really, it is about like, how do we talk to people? How do we engage them in the way that doesn't just sound theoretical, and kind of jump over this barrier of, ew, evil socialism or ew, evil communism. And then, of course, like, I do think it's important to get to the point where we can have these conversations that, yeah, like a lot of people were organizing as anarchists and as communists and as socialists. But that feels to me like a later conversation that should be had after people are already like kind of in the fight with you.
Another really interesting interview closer to the end, and I forget the fellow's name, but he was talking about how, you know, everything is sort of political, and, you know, you may not be into politics, but politics is going to find you. And I found it interesting because I know academics and sort of, I don't want to say limousine liberals, but like, you know, the sort of more cosmopolitan liberals that I know from the city areas, kids that are like highly educated grad school types that will say everything is political. They'll put it in a little bit of different wording, but both of those people are saying the same thing. And I think we forget about that a lot of times when we talk about demographics and culture. There is a lot of like universal common ground.
Totally. And yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorite bits. And I use it in the trailer as well, in one of the trailers. And that's Terry Steele. He's a former coal miner and a member of the UMWA. And works closely with the Mine Wars Museum in Matewan. And, you know, his point was, like, whether you like it or not, you know, he was basically saying that people who say I'm not political are stupid. And then he's like, I don't mean to hurt anyone's feelings, but that's just a stupid comment. Because, and then he goes on to describe, you know, like, part of his day and how everything about it is political. Like, the creek by his house is political because, is it clean? Is it filled with coal slurry? That's political. The streets that you drive on are political. When does your trash get picked up? Or does it not get picked up? That's political. So it's really, like, I think one of the things that is so powerful and hopeful about organizing in these, like, grassroots and poor communities, as opposed to, you know, kind of like the limousine liberal that you're talking about, is that these people are much closer to the negative policies, right, than somebody who lives on, like, the Upper East Side. They have the ability, the privilege to have this, like, buffer between them and the, like, the designed failings of the system. Whereas somebody living in, like, the bayous of Louisiana, where their land is rapidly, like, disappearing under their feet, they are much more directly impacted by these policies. And so I think that that's, like, a really powerful point of making it clear that, like, well, this disappearing land is political, and making that connection. And I know it's become kind of like this dog whistle, like, oh, the personal and the political. But it really, like, it is true when you look at these, like, specific communities, particularly, like, sacrifice zones and things like that. It is deeply political, and that's a powerful point that's being made by folks like Terry, who organizes in his community, highlighting how these people's daily lives. Because that's the other thing, like, when you're organizing, one of the things that you have to make clear is, like, well, why does it matter? You know, why does this matter to me and my struggle? And this is so important to have that, because so many people are so weighed down by their struggle that if you're asking them to give energy to something else, they don't have it because they're a single parent, or they work three jobs, or both, or, you know, so, like, really connecting it to somebody's, like, personal experience is so important.
I was going to say, too, I want to clarify I don't know if I should say limousine liberals, because that sounds like it's such a right-wing talking point, though, at this point. I always tell people, I think capital creates space, like, literal space between people. The more wealth people have, the farther and farther away they move from other people. I saw that in LA and was horrified by it, because the richer you were, the higher and higher up you lived in the hills. But it creates this disconnect. Like, I speak to people where I'm living now, in the suburbs, whereas I had lived in the city before, and they're thinking, oh, you know, well, what we can do to fix all this stuff and help Black Lives Matter is we just need to, like, get rid of the blackface episodes of the Golden Girls, or, you know, have the Black national anthem on, you know, the NFL games, and then everyone will be happy. Let's get rid of the Cops show, too. And I do hate the show Cops, but it's weird, because I think, you know, you live in a suburban bubble, you sort of view things through the simulation of TV, and you're missing the point that really Black Lives Matter is saying, we don't care about any of that. Just stop killing us.
Right. Totally. And, you know, here in DC, for instance, like, I don't know if we were the first, but, and that's not a feather in our cap either. But the mayor here, Mayor Bowser, who has, in all of her policy, made it very clear that she does not believe that Black Lives Matter, painted, you know, outside the White House, the street that goes to the White House, 16th Street, Black Lives Matter. And the Black Lives Matter organizers were all like, I didn't ask for that. What is this? This is nonsense. And then, of course, they added an equal sign that says defund the police, which, you know, good on them. That was a nice little artistic addition. But yeah, I mean, this is, and I wrote an article about this for Mint Press News, and called it struggle theater. You know, it's the idea that these sort of platitudes equal actual change. And of course, what this means is that they're afraid that we might keep pushing. And they're really hoping that just by plastering Black Lives Matter a bunch of places, they'll get us to shut up and go home.
Well, no, I was just going to say real quick, I agree But I think, like, I know well-meaning people from around where I'm living right now that really do think, oh, this is what Black Lives Matter wants. And it's because they've never gone out and ventured out into the world beyond their suburbs. And that to me is like the problem. We're so disconnected. I didn't mean to interrupt you, though. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Bringing it back to the original point. I do think that that's a big problem. And this is something that, like, I've thought about quite a bit, that whereas growing up in Sweden, there's sort of like a Swedish, you know, not identity, because that sounds very, like, you know, Aryan.
Isn't there a Jante's Swedish law in Sweden?
Is there a what?
Jante's law. Have you heard of that?
I haven't.
It's I guess it's a thing in Scandinavian countries. It's these 9 rules from this novel, and they're all variations on, like, you're not, like, above the community. Hmm. I thought you may have heard of it, because it's apparently popular in Scandinavian countries. It seems much more collectivist.
Well, yeah, I mean, we are definitely more collectivist in Scandinavia, although Sweden is inching.
I hear that's changing a lot in Sweden.
I have a whole, I could do an entire other show just on my issues with one of my home countries, but I think, like, you know, the difference is that there's no, like, American experience, right? Like, we are so divided, literally and figuratively, like you talked about with, like, the actual space. The experience of someone in, you know, let's say, like, the Pacific Northwest is vastly different than the experience of someone in, you know, West Texas, or in Louisiana, or in Maine. Like, there is no, we pretend that there is on, like, July 4th and stuff, but there really isn't. And so the idea that, like, we feel disconnected from these issues that we really all share is just, I mean, of course, because we're so spread out, we're so divided, and so many people, like you said, don't have the ability or the privilege to get in touch with people who have these different experiences. You know, a lot of people that I grew up with in North Carolina never left the state. And so then how are you going to talk to them about, like, what's happening in the Dakotas with, like, the Dakota Access Pipeline? They're just like, I don't get it. And, you know, a lot of that is also, of course, the propagandization that says, like, you should look down on these people. But a lot of that is also, like, you know, there's a reason that people say, oh, traveling is so important for expanding your mind. Just traveling inside the U.S., because the U.S. is, like, a collection of countries, and, you know, both culturally and, of course, in terms of environment. So I think that, I mean, part of why I think, you know, like, film or art in general, like, you know, like my site is called Art Killing Apathy. I think part of what art can do is allow people to feel those connections outside of their purview. You know, like, I might never go to Syria, but I've read essays by, you know, fighters in Rojava. And so I feel a connection there, even though I might never physically go there. And so I think that that's why, like, art and these sort of essays or reports are so important, because when you can get that to people, it really allows people to see past their, like, suburbia, or past their, you know, hills and hollers or swamps or whatever, and see the experiences that people have outside, and also thereby recognize, oh, I can relate to that in some way. And I feel a solidarity with this person who doesn't look like me or believe in what I believe, but we have this in common. And that is really where we can build a lot of power.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I'm having a filmmaker on who works in sort of Black-oriented cinema. And I dig that stuff, right? But someone said to me, well, you're into, like, Black novels and Black cinema. How do you understand it? Because you're a white dude. And I'm just like, well, you know, if it's a movie about an alienated Black man, right? I mean, I may not experience alienation in the same way, right? But I think we've all experienced alienation, so I can still relate to, you know, a piece of art that deals with that subject. I may not live in West Virginia, but I can still connect on some level with the sense of alienation or the sense of despair that some of the subjects express in your documentary.
Totally. And, you know, I think that empathy is very much constricted and shanked by capitalism, but it is something that is brought back by artistic expression. And by that, I don't just mean like, you know, the typical mediums, but even just like creative thinking, like creative tactics, thinking outside the confines of a capitalist system. You know, that's where we can build this empathy and hearing these stories. You know, I remember when I first heard about, like when I first became radicalized, I think was when I was like 11, and somebody told me that they were killing tigers just to make their, to make like nice rugs and stuff. And I was like, obviously I don't know what that feels like. I'm not a tiger, but I felt that that was awful and I wanted to do something. So I like, you know, gave my allowance to the World Wildlife Fund or something. But like, but this is, I mean, that is so important to build that sense of empathy, because that really gets crushed by this system and by, you know, you mentioned like the sort of collective thinking. The US is so individualistic, like my home, my stuff, my experience, my understanding of the world, and art and, you know, just like these sort of shared experiences have the ability to knock that down and really see that, for instance, we're not on top of the ecosystem. We're a part of it. We're a necessary part of it. We're dependent upon it. We're not above our communities. We're dependent upon each other as community members to survive and thrive. And so that's incredibly vital.
It's interesting you mentioned the tiger thing as well, because I just had a flashback to when my parents took me to a circus the one time, and outside there were a few protesters, and they handed out a little pamphlet to me, and they said, you know, they tase like the elephants and the tigers and whatnot. And then I was like probably 10 at the time, maybe a little younger. And I was like, I don't think I want to go to circuses anymore. So sometimes the activism helps. You can get to the young people.
Yeah, totally. Especially young people, because they haven't put up those, like those, you know, those programmed barriers as much yet. And I think that's, you know, a lot of these community centers are targeted by government officials because they do that. You know, like a lot of the targets of the Black Panthers were places that were also doing, you know, schooling outside of the horrific schooling that was available to poor Black kids, still is. So I think, you know, that's incredibly important, this sort of like bringing in the youth. And also, as one of my friends says, who has an organization that he calls, like the tagline is occupy or invading white spaces. But he says, like, you know, getting out of the way of the youth as well, because they have ideas that haven't to the same extent been pushed through this capitalistic paradigm. And so they're more willing to think outside the box. And that's, again, that's why, you know, creative works and creative ideas are so important, because they really are the antithesis of this like very confined and structured capitalist paradigm that just forces us into thinking like, my goal is to make money and to buy the things and to have more stuff.
You know, there were two more things I wanted to touch on real briefly, if you have the time. Mm-hmm. The first was, I'll give a brief story really quickly. I always tell people it's kind of weird living in Pennsylvania at this moment in time, because if I go out to rural areas and I go to a gas station, let's say, I'll go to the restroom in the gas station and I'll see blue lights everywhere. And they have the blue lights there because there's issues with people shooting up, and people, it's interesting because people always say, what blue lights? Why do they have blue lights? Like, it's because of the epidemic, right? The heroin overdoses, the opioid epidemic. And that's actually a big part of the film, or at least a portion of it. How does the opioid epidemic tie into what is happening in West Virginia?
Yeah, so West Virginia holds the very uncoveted first place of most opioid deaths from the epidemic per capita. So basically, West Virginia has roughly like 1.8 million people living there, and the borough of Brooklyn in New York City has 2 million, just to give like an idea of scale. 1 in 400 people have died in West Virginia due to the opioid epidemic, and many more have had their lives destroyed from the opioid epidemic. And basically, like, West Virginia is the perfect collection of triggers for addiction. You know, if you look at like the science behind addiction, they say that it's like isolation, either physical or mental or emotional, trauma and stress. well, what better place than a place that's filled with people who do manual labor, which is very taxing physically, which causes, of course, physical pain and stress, but also the stress of, well, this industry might not be here for long, or this industry is getting rid of people. I might not have a job. I need something to turn to. How do I get through the day? I feel isolated and forgotten and cast aside by both the government and the industry that I had grown up feeling cared about me. All of these things come together. On top of that, of course, you have like a younger generation of people who are basically looking to the future without hope because they see the coal industry dying, or they see that fracking isn't doing as well, like the industry isn't doing as well as people had hoped, right? So these are perfect triggers. It's a perfect storm for addiction. And so it's really not surprising that West Virginia holds that first place, particularly when you look at the state of our healthcare system, or what I call the sick care system, because people don't have access to healthcare. You know, their only way is to go to, you know, like someone like Dr. No, who's like, nope, you're fine. or like here, you know, what really, another thing that's really happened is that they started prescribing opioids to manual laborers and saying, you know, just keep working and work through the pain. Here, have these magic little pills. And they get addicted, even though, you know, the Sackler family said, you're not going to get addicted to this. Before you know it, they are stuck between a rock and a hard place. And then they're
there's even some people, the reason I mentioned heroin is because people forget, they'll have the opioids taken away from them now that it's seen as an issue with healthcare. And I've known people that have gone from, you know, prescribed opioids to heroin, and people forget that happens too. It's, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, these are all connected, and, you know, it even connects to our imperialism. The fact that, what is it, like something like 95% of opioids come from, or opiates come from Afghanistan, and we're protecting poppy fields with armed military. Like, all of this is connected. And of course, that speaks to, you know, these sort of interconnections with regards to public health and the way that we view healthcare as not being a human right. Because let's say that we had socialized healthcare, let's say that we had universal healthcare, and we also had like a, you know, like Portugal has, where being addicted to drugs is considered a public health issue rather than a criminal issue. If you had those two things, West Virginia would be doing astronomically better than it is today. So it's really, again, it's like a perfect storm of, you know, the worst machinations of industry and, you know, profit over people.
I like that you mentioned too the sort of isolation aspect of addiction, because I've always said to people, I'm like, you know, if you really wanted to, you know, help addicts out, you wouldn't be having a war on drugs. You would be making sure that, you know, we don't treat addicts as, you know, lepers or pariahs, and we give them social support. Mm-hmm. It would probably lead to a lot better outcomes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is a health issue. It's not a criminal issue, and throwing them in jail does not help.
Last thing I wanted to touch upon was the water aspect of what's going on in West Virginia, because I don't think I fully grasped it. It's very frightening to me. Maybe you could explain a little to my audience.
Yeah, so I think one of the most horrific like shifts has happened with regards to water, because, you know, people might be familiar with charcoal filters. You can buy those to filter your water, and they're excellent. And West Virginia had that naturally, right? Because they had all that coal in the mountains. So what they went from basically some of the best water in, you know, in the U.S. to what they have now, which is water that is, you know, basically undrinkable. And basically that what happens is when they do mountaintop removal, and water is being poisoned, you know, in the old way of mining as well, but this is on a different scale because of our technological advancement. This is, you know, a place where technological advancement has not been good, has made it so that we can destroy more quicker. And so basically when you blow the top off a mountain, you have to put that somewhere. And most of the time they'll just dump that decapitated mountain into a valley. And along with that, all of the chemicals that go into you know, digging the coal out, exploding the mountain. And then on top of that, you also have coal treatment, because you have to do it, you basically have to wash the coal. You have to take the and get like the impurities out, because the burners will get gummed up with like dirt and impurities if you don't. So what happens is they'll wash it with a chemical, which is of course their proprietary blend, and it's not something that's available to the public because it's a quote trade secret. So the public isn't even allowed to know what they're being poisoned with. And then they will wash the coal with this and then dump this sludge, this toxic chemical cocktail, also into these valleys, these unlined earthen dams filled with what's called coal slurry. And then, of course, that'll seep into the ground, and it seeps into the groundwater. And before you know it, you have places like Prenter, which is what they call a holler in West Virginia. 98% of the inhabitants in Prenter basically developed gallbladder disease, which... I mean, those numbers, there were also cases of liver disease, liver failure. So this is what we now have thanks to the coal industry. And, you know, this has happened on, I think it was like in 2013, there was what was called the water crisis, where thousands of gallons of this coal cleaning product, MCHM, leaked into the water supply for 300,000 people. And they basically didn't do anything about it. The only thing the governor did was he came on television and said, I just want everyone to know that this had nothing to do with coal.
Well, there were even statements made, right? Like, we can't say that it's not, you know, contaminated water, but it may be, but we can't say that it is, you know, it may be, you know, sort of like plausible deniability.
Yeah, like we're not saying drink it, but I mean, I'm not going to say that it's contaminated. So it's
right, right. It was the whole like, we're not saying it's safe to drink. Right. But we're not saying it isn't either.
Right. And so it's the, it's like the total failure of the government to do its job and basically, you know, just bow down to industry. And, you know, later they found that this chemical is not only incredibly dangerous, but it has severe reproductive effects. So it could be generations from now that we're still seeing the effects of this spill on the people of West Virginia. And, you know, the same thing is true for fracking. Like I said, like that transition of power is also the transition of toxicity, both in terms of, you know, everything from public health to income inequality to the environment. And, you know, the smell that you get when you're driving down the fracking corridor in West Virginia, it smells like sick and chemical, and you can't really see it, but you can smell it. You can smell these fracking chemicals, and there are constantly, you know, these little spills, and people don't report them. You know, I spoke to people who said, oh yeah, there was a leak. It sounded pretty ferocious, but we just called them and they said it's no big deal. I mean, it's, and of course you call the government and they're like, yeah, it's no big deal. So the contamination is still happening very much in coal country, and very much in fracking country. And, the water is a big fight.
So before we close out, I always like to end on a positive note. Maybe we can get to that positive note, through the title of the documentary, Hard Road of Hope. I guess the hard road part is, you know, the dark part, but there's hope at the end. What, why do we say Hard Road of Hope?
So this is actually, it's actually something that Paul, one of the guys in the film, said to me. Basically, like, and he didn't explain it, but I, as soon as he said it, I related to it very heavily. Because I was also reminded of Revolutionary Suicide, the autobiography by Huey P. Newton, where he writes that he has hope and dignity when he fights for his community. And I think that's, like, I've felt that for a long time, this hope without optimism, optimism being this feeling that, like, everything's just going to be fine, so I can sit back and do nothing. Hope is that I think things can be okay if, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that that is what we as organizers and, you know, even like activist journalists fight for, is this hope, this idea that, like, we know that the power structures are flimsy. They count on our complicity. And if we can shift that so we are no longer complicit, that we are pushing them back, then we have the ability to manifest the goals that we care about and build the communities that we want to see. And so I think that, and you can see that already with things like, police departments being defunded and these conversations being had. So I think, the hope part is what keeps us going. It's this knowledge that there is no such thing as an empire that can't be toppled. In fact, all empires eventually are toppled. And Ursula K. Le Guin, wrote that, capitalism seems like an insurmountable force, but so did the divine right of kings, So I think that's hope part is that, we know that these things can be toppled because they have in the past. And it's just a matter of us, coming full circle, like the mine workers, and banding together, and not just articulating what we're against, but what we're for, and building that.
And also, I want to give you a chance to let my listeners know not only how they can get the documentary Hard Road of Hope or how they can watch it, but also you have a podcast with Lee Camp, I believe Common Censored. You have a few podcasts, so throw out any of the work you're doing. You're one of the busiest women I know, and you also have one of the warmest personalities. I don't know how you're able to manage it all, but...
Well, I find that that being an ass actually takes more energy than not being an ass, so... the film is up at hardroadofhope.com, and you can find out more about my projects at artkillingapathy.com. Like you mentioned, I have the podcast with Lee Camp, Common Censored. I also have a bi-monthly podcast called Act Out that's a bit more like into the nerdery, so to speak. I'm the projects that I'm working on, the articles that I write, all of that you can access via artkillingapathy.com.
Awesome. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Eleanor Goldfield, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you.
We got to organize and build support. We got to work together. Together. Till they can't get their coal out of the ground without us, cause we're a union. Cause we're the workers, damn it, and we take care of each other.
And I hope that all of you are taking care of each other in these uncertain times. That does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Eleanor Goldfield. Be sure to check out not only her documentary, Hard Road of Hope, but also her podcasts, Act Out, and the Common Censored podcast, which she co-hosts with comedian Lee Camp. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/ParallaxViews. Producers credit shoutouts to Martin, Mark, Amelia, Gary, and Brace. You are helping to keep this show going with your $10 monthly donation. If you haven't yet, please consider joining those listeners in supporting my work so that we can keep Parallax Views going and growing. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.